Well, good evening. We now are having our third session in the White House Communications course, and we're very fortunate tonight to have White House Counselor Dan Bartlett and from the Clinton administration, Mike McCurry, who was press secretary to President Clinton. And tonight we want to talk about White House communications and get some differences, idea of the differences between Democrats and Republicans, if there are any, and what similarities there are in terms of their organization and how they communicate, and also talk a bit about presidential campaigns and first and second terms and the differences that you all see between them. In starting off, let's just start off and talk generally about presidential communications and the views that your presidents have of communications, of where communications fits into governing. And well, let's start with you, Dan.
Ever since I've worked for President Bush, and this dates back to when he was governor of Texas, he has, I think, had a keen understanding of the role that communications plays in public policy, in governing. You can have the greatest idea, but if you're not able to articulate it in a way in which the public understands it and supports it, then it doesn't really matter how good of an idea it is. And he has, there's been some, I think I've noticed in Washington, at least when I first got here, that there's a tendency I've seen mostly on Capitol Hill, for example, where policymakers or the principals go hash out the policy and then they come out and they hand it to the community and say, now go sell this. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard way to do it because you have to have an understanding of how policy is developed, and I think it's important that the communications aspect of a policy or the selling of or however you want to put it needs to be understood by the people who are making the decisions because it can help them better understand the climate in which it's nothing is done in a vacuum. So the president, even as he was governor, when Karen Hughes, who I used to work for, was running communications in Texas and then also when we were here, has always had a seat at the table during the policy debate or production process, which I think is critically important. But it is, and I think also in a unique, more unique sense, a president who's also commander-in-chief during a time of war, so much responsibility is left to the president to speak to the public about the conduct of the war, to educate them, to, I think, one of the most critical communications moments for this president was the speech to the American people on September 20th from Congress, in which was the first time to really articulate and define and educate the public about what we're up against. There are a lot of conversation, a lot of different terms we take for granted now, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, things like that, that at that point was barely understood by the public and had to really use as an opportunity. So there's a particular responsibility I think the president understands in during a time of war and the role that he plays as commander-in-chief, you almost become educator-in-chief to speak directly about the conduct of the war. And so that aspect of it, I think, in particular is important.
And what about on Social Security? Has that been frustrating for him that he has talked about his role as an educator, the importance of being the educator on this, and that the numbers opposed to those personal accounts have gone up?
Well, I think that is more of a product of the lack
of relentless opposition.
There's that, but more so, I think, is this instant gratification aspect of where we live. You know, everybody's wanting a result immediately. It's been 33 days since the president has spoken to the country about this in the State of the Union. It's one of the hardest legislative lifts that any president domestically would take on. That's why it doesn't. Mm-hmm. That's why we have the problem we're faced with today. It's a complex issue. But he is not at all discouraged about it, as we have said in football parlance, this is still the first quarter. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of debate left. There's a lot of educating left to do. And if you peel back the numbers a little bit as far as public opinion, most or any of the, and there's two public opinion polls in the last 10 days that came out that showed, that indicated drop in support. And I won't go into the screening of the poll and how mm-hmm. the poll was skewed. But most of the decline was among people who would not even be eligible for it. There was among seniors. Mm-hmm. So we have to do a continue our job as far as educating, particularly the senior population, those who were born before 1950, that this doesn't affect them. But it's a complicated communications because the past politics of this issue, the complexity of the issue, and you're asking the public to understand and be motivated to do something, and politicians to do something that is a pending. It's not acute in the sense
right.
that,
uh-huh.
like in 1983, literally checks weren't going to be able to go out the door. Mm-hmm. This is different, and we're making the case why we need to solve it now because the problem's only going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't do it this year, which I think we will, but if it were not, that doesn't mean checks aren't going to go out the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. Mike, what about with Clinton?
Well, let me do a step back and do a little compare and contrast, and then I'll talk specifically about Social Security as kind of a real-time test of a capacity for a White House to communicate about difficult subjects. The general proposition is that there is a cultural difference between the way in which Democratic and Republican White Houses communicate. We would take just as equally as seriously as President Bush in this White House the need to get your ideas and your message and your program out in front of the American people so you can generate support. But I think Democrats have historically and specifically under President Clinton went about that in a different way. We tend to misunderestimate the press a lot and think that they are probably kind of on our side because they sort of like speaking truth to power, and we Democrats are out there in the streets getting everything organized. And if you scratch around, most Democrats who are in senior positions in politics or in policy making, they either came out of the labor community or they came out of the environmental community or the feminist movement or the civil rights community or the anti-war community in the 1960s. So they're about getting out there and getting organized. And over time, we always kind of made the assumption that these rabble-rousing, muckraking reporters were probably with us because they wanted to be for the little people and the average folks, too, that we thought we were fighting for. Well, of course, that's dead wrong because the press, as Dan's former colleague Ari Fleischer argues in his new book, which I will quote but have not read, which you can do if you're a Washington pundit, I guess. But he makes the case that their bias is for controversy and conflict and a good storyline, much more so than a political bias in favor of one party or another. What it means is that Democrats have generally approached dealing with the press like they're friends, and we should hang out together and try to work with each other and be nice to each other and all just get along there in that briefing room. And generally what happens is when the press is just equally nasty to Democratic presidents and the press is not so great and the president's screaming at the press secretary, why is the press so mean, we revert back to the model that the Republicans used from the very beginning, which is treat them like the caged animals they are, bring them out once a day, feed them, and if they don't behave, cut off their, you know, ration of raw meat every day. I think of Republicans on the other side, and historically this goes back, Martha's the expert on this, but I think this goes all the way back to a guy named Herb Klein, who was the communications director for President Richard Nixon and really established the contours of the White House, the modern White House communications apparatus, much as it exists with some, you know, some new bells and whistles even today. But it was their singular observation that you had to approach communications from the bully pulpit of the White House just like you would, you know, a major corporate effort to take a product and put it in a compelling, attractive, and persuasive way in front of the American people. That you had to organize yourself to have a message. You had to repeat yourself constantly. You had to be very conscious of what the visual element of the storyline would be, and you had to be adept at those things like advertising, public relations, that I think came more naturally to Republicans, because as a culture, they grow more comfortably out of corporate America and the techniques that I think are used often for mass communication. So over time in history, Republicans start right off in the beginning not trying to pretend that the press are friends, that they're there really to be a part of the process that gets information to the American people, and that good White Houses have to be very disciplined and very methodic about how they organize themselves to tell a story every day and make sure the press pays attention. And I think the current White House has been unsurpassed, maybe, in its ability to kind of keep a tight rein on the message and prevent people from straying off the reservation. I think it's arguable maybe that this has been one of the best White House communications mechanisms in the history of the modern presidency, because they've served this president, I think, exceedingly well. Now, whether that's to the good of the American people who need information and need the window lifted from time to time on the processes of government so you get to take a peek in and see what's happening, that's something that you all ought to argue in the good papers that you write for Professor Kumar in this class. My own argument is that sometimes you can be very disciplined and be very controlled in message and try to get facts out there and do everything you can to be supportive of the president. But if you don't open up the window a little bit and make more transparent the give and take that occurs within government, the arguments that do happen, the reasons why these issues are complex to begin with, you don't help the American people understand the difficult choices and trade-offs that need to be made. And I guess a good example of that, maybe to close the loop, is Social Security now. We're at the same place we have been for roughly a generation. Everybody knows that the baby boom is going to retire and that there has to be some combination of reductions in benefits or increases in payments into the program by today's workers for that glut of the baby boom to get the Social Security promise that's currently been extended to them. We're going to have to reform that entitlement program one way or another. Every candidate for president, every politician in Washington pretty much knows that. But because it is such an incendiary, quote-unquote, third rail issue, very few presidents have the courage necessary to go out and touch that third rail and do something about it. Now, this president is doing it, but he's put himself in a tough position to do that by being for tax cuts that have really put the country's fiscal picture in a long-term process of deficit projections that then make it a little tough to turn around and make an argument about entitlement programs that sort of make people ask, well, where's the money in the first place that's been promised? That's not to say that I don't give President Bush credit for trying. It's also not to say that I think Democrats are making a mistake by just sitting there on their hands and, you know, waiting for the president to get out there and do the hard work of proposing things, because I think sooner or later someone's going to turn to the Democrats and say, okay, you're so bright, what would you do about this problem? And when that'll be a day of reckoning when that happens. The more Machiavellian might suggest, and we can ask Mr. Bartlett since he's sitting here, the president knows he's not going to pass this Social Security reform bill, but that's not what this is about. This is about them talking to 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and really telling them that we're the party that cares about your future. And behind this is the evil genius Karl Rove, who plans all these things out politically.
I didn't think you were that jaded anymore.
I'm just being provocative. We're straying off subject here. The main point.
Yes, I agree.
The main point is that there really is and you can feel it. And I think you would agree with this. You can feel the difference between a way a Democratic White House communicates and a Republican White House. It's true that all White House communications operations reflect the president one way or another. I really think that's true. I think the way the White House communications operation runs now is because that's the way George Bush wants it. And I'll tell you, a lot of what we did and did not do during the Clinton years was because that's the way President Clinton wanted it. And, you know, they're the ones that have to live with the results in history, so they have a right to, you know, set the overall tone, I think. But my argument is that there really is also underneath that some just differences in the political chemistry of both political parties that lead you to different models of interaction when it comes to dealing with the press and dealing with the public.
Well, you could say that the Republicans, when they come in, bring management types. They don't bring issue
bring
people.
Chaos.
That's right. You bring the 100 percenters, people who want 100% of what they want, and people who are committed on particular issues. But Republicans tend to plan ahead, and when you plan ahead, you're going to have a more successful beginning on your term. So they bring in planners, and they think through communications, and you can see it in every Republican administration from World War II on. The Eisenhower administration did it as well as Nixon and Reagan and you all. But do you all think that in by the second term, let's say you could start out with Democrats being chaotic and then organize it as time goes on? You all didn't have a lot of leaks. Second term.
By the second term, we got much better. Those with short memories will remember in 1995, we had a budget fight with Newt Gingrich that President Clinton prosecuted and won, and I think largely secured his reelection based on that debate. We won reelection rather easily in 1996. For most of 1997, we were negotiating out the particulars of a balanced budget agreement in the face of a very angry press corps that thought that Clinton had gotten away scot-free in the re-election and had not faced difficult questions. So they made the life of the press secretary completely miserable with stories about campaign finance scandals and Chinese arms merchants going to breakfast at the White House. That's most of 1997. And we finally had things back on plan. We said, we're gonna really show that we know how to use the commanding heights of presidential communications effectively. And we put together, I think, one of the best communications plans ever put together for a State of the Union rollout, and began methodically in January of 1998 to leak out portions of what the president would propose. We just dominated the press. Everything was going together, and I was kind of rubbing my hands together and saying, yes, we finally have a second term. And then 3 days before the State of the Union address, we all met a young lady named Monica Lewinsky, and things changed.
In the Bush administration in the second term, it appears as if you all are loosening up in the kind of information that's provided. For example, during the first term, you all didn't do a lot of briefings that were to the press corps, you know, as a whole, but you've been doing many more of those. And is there something in particular that's driving that, an idea of what you want from the second term? Plus, the president has been doing a press conference a month, a solo press conference a month. In fact, he may...
he keeps getting your reports about how far behind he is.
Martha, don't call attention to it or you'll jinx it.
Well, you see, he has a chance to become the first president in history to have more solo press conferences in his second term than his first.
A lofty goal to aspire.
Is it the case that you all have thought about the communications of the second term and you've seen it differently?
I think it's a combination of things. One, the complexity of the issues and the goals, not to say that they're any less or more ambitious than the first term, that in and of itself requires a heavier, you know, a much heavier lift, not only from the president, and I think he is demonstrating that on the type of travel and commitment he's going to time and energy and commitment he's going to make, put to the issue of Social Security or else, but also on issues of foreign policy as well. If you look at the rapid developments that are taking place throughout the Middle East, for example, and they're very complex and require a considerable amount of backgrounding and briefing and understanding what's going on. And I think the people involved, why they may not say it themselves, but I think staffers or administration people have the fear of making a mistake. Mm-hmm. And when you're making a mistake before the president's going before the people for re-election, it has a different consequence than maybe a mistake when he's no longer running for re-election. So that while nobody's ever said that to me, I have that I get that sense from people.
Uh-huh.
But because in a political environment, a campaign environment, things can be taken out of context or misconstrued or used against you in a way that somebody would fear be used in a politically harmful way to their boss. And obviously mm-hmm. nobody wants to be put in that precarious situation.
Mm-hmm.
We went most of 1996 without doing a single press conference with President Clinton. Nobody mm-hmm. noted that when they were chasing after your boss, but for the same reason, in large part that you didn't want to expose yourself to problems. And then the other thing, I really was, it was a little more philosophical too. At some point when the people are paying attention and making a choice about electing a president, it's not about the press being the filter anymore.
Right.
You're having a direct conversation with the American people. Both candidates are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're entitled to have that conversation back and forth between each other in debates and in the argument of the campaign trail and then, you know, the presentations that you're making directly to voters. And that's what voting in a presidential election is about. So I think you can make a case that the obligation to constantly put yourself there in front of the quote-unquote surrogates for the public, which mm-hmm. is the way the press sees their role, that's less demanding in a re-election cycle than it is when you're starting out in a new term and trying to build new constituencies and taking on new issues.
Right. I will say that, harkening back a little bit to some of the opening remarks that Mike made, and we'll have a debate about tax cuts later. He mentioned Herb Klein from President Nixon, and I've had the pleasure of meeting with Herb a couple times. He's still out in California and still very politically active. And I think you're right. A level of discipline and organization and planning is always, I think, a critical part of effective communications. The thing that I would add that's the biggest difference between when Herb is around and when we're doing is the media climate we're working in,
sure.
which is much different. I think it's all the more important. The more diverse news becomes and how many different outlets people have to get their news and the blurring of the news cycle 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the more important to be more disciplined because it's that much easier to be pulled off of your message. It's easier to go down, you know, various rabbit trails that could be, I've always said is, you know, there's kind of a difference between in investing parlance, I've used it as some can be what's called like day traders, which is each day you wake up, see where the news cycle is and play to the current of the news cycle, and you can get on the evening news that day on whatever the issue du jour may be, and you can look at it and say at the end of the day, oh wow, we got president to give a soundbite on X issue. Let's say it's on education because there's a huge report showing something went up on education or something happened in that or development. And you can do that from day in, day out, week to week. But what you find yourself doing is after 180 days or 6 months or a year, what is the sum total of all those hits on the evening news? Is there a consistency in message to which something actually penetrated from that people can take away from there? Or is it just a bunch of, you know, disparate news items in which the president has commented on? And I've always said our approach has been more of kind of like a long-term investor, and that is let's set out a goal of what we want to communicate over a certain period of time, 6 months, a year, whatever it may be, and let's plan proactively what we want to do. Let's be flexible if a situation comes up. Now, there's going to be things that you just have to comment on, I separate those, international incidents, whatever they may be. But then we have to have the discipline when there looks like an attractive thing to talk about that day. Say, well, does that really advance our goal? Does that advance what we're trying to communicate? Because that's got to be your test each day is say, does this advance the goal of what we're trying to achieve, whether it be Social Security, the war on terror, whatever the issues that you've, strategic issues you've outlined, or not? And when you have so many more different media outlets and you have a constant news cycle, that becomes more of a challenge. It's more tempting, I think, to jump into the news current of the day or whatever it may be. So that's been a challenge that my sense is that only the Clinton administration and this Bush administration can appreciate, because that's really when the advent of 24-hour news cycle 7 days a week really
right.
has hit.
And you could say in 96, both Fox and MSNBC came to the White House. And what was the impact? How did you all use the opportunity and then deal with the problems that would present?
Well, that was an extension of what the reality of having CNN on at the White House every day meant, because it was, you know, news was constantly there, and you'd be sitting in meetings trying to figure out how you were going to go out and present an argument and look up, and then Wolf Blitzer was already out reporting what you were about to do in front of the White House. So this pace at which you had to try to stay ahead of the news cycle in order to keep the discussion coherent is what really accelerated most. And then I think also, Dan's right, the proliferation of all these news sources, some reliable and some completely unreliable, that would just inject new information out into the public debate, and you had to contend with where that would all lead. It was in 1996, I think, when Matt Drudge first started injecting his own particular perspective into the public debate. And at first it was largely ignored, and most news organizations said we're not going to legitimize this creature of the internet because that doesn't represent real journalism. Well, that debate's long since been solved. That's just as much a part of the public debate now, that whatever anyone wants to put on a blog or in a internet cheat sheet can be instantaneously part of the debate. Dan makes a very important point, and I'll give you another kind of a admission against interest, another example of where I think that we took our eye off this important distinction of long-term investing versus day trading was during the campaign. We'd sit around after the network news was on every night at the Kerry campaign and just sort of, you know, cheer and be so gleeful over the fact that we had just killed the other side on the network news that night. And, you know, we'd say, we own the networks tonight. Well, network news coverage is declining. The percentage of people who really, mm-hmm. for whom that matters and who are relying upon network news in order to get information that would be critical to making their decisions, as that point in the campaign where we were really gleeful that we were kicking the Bush's butts every day, you know, most of the people had decided one way or another which way they were going to vote. The undecided voters that were out there probably, almost certainly were not people who were tuned into the network news, watching it avidly, trying to wrestle with whether they were going to vote for Bush or for Kerry. So I think that sense that you have to go back, look back over a four-year pretty determined effort on the part of the Bush White House to identify parts of the electorate that they wanted to talk to in a very serious way, and I think a fairly sophisticated effort to really go out and identify special audiences that they knew that they had to work very hard to get their message in front of, and they did that, I think, quite well. And I think we woke up after the election and began looking at how effectively they had communicated and how they had really taken advantage of this notion that there is now a new media that has replaced the old media. We don't gather around the network campfire every night and listen to Walter Cronkite tell us that's the way it is. You know, it's just because we've lost that coherency. We're just as likely to be catching the latest headline because we've been busy during the day off of Jon Stewart and The Daily Show at night, because that might be the first time we have to catch up on whatever the news of the day happened to be. I think recognizing that those ways in which people are getting information now have changed dramatically, and that they are sometimes moving even away from a media-driven model and much more to peer relationships, person-to-person, grassroots organizers who are, you know, walking up and knocking on doors. I mean, we might be seeing some real fundamental change in political communication and the way people get information to make decisions, and I think all White Houses going forward are going to have to account for that and think about how they organize themselves to get the message out. I do think, though, that model that goes all the way back to 1972, that's going to be about precision, discipline, making sure that your message is vivid and easily accessible and really grabs people's attention, I think those will be fundamental elements of communication for a long time to come.
Mm-hmm. And
one thing I want to add also, when we talk about the challenges the news cycle has put on people who are in the jobs that I'm in now or Mike used to be in, is it's a two-way street. It's put huge amount of challenges on the reporters who are covering us as well. Mm-hmm. They've got editors banging on them every day saying, keep up with the news cycle themselves. So they're constantly having to try to feel like they're staying ahead of the person walking out on the lawn every day doing 7-minute live shots every other on the half hour. Mm-hmm. And that in of itself puts puts a strain on the relationship in of itself as well. So I think that's, it's not just us. I think it all, my sense of it is it's put reporters in tough positions as well.
And it's put the whole of the news organization, because the news organization then has to figure if it's print and publishes once a day, you know, how do they get into
it? And if you're Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News, it's a whole different,
a
weekly news magazine now? I mean, it's ancient by the time it comes out.
But the organization of the process of keeping the public informed still pretty much follows the model that has existed for generations now. Mm-hmm. And you've got a briefing room at the White House. Reporters file in twice a day. A press secretary unloads some material on them. The president does one or two events that are the message events of the day. The press traipses in and covers that, and occasionally gets to ask a question or two, but not often. And that's pretty much the way it's been done for a long, long time. And given the sophistication of the technologies that are available and the ways in which we could actually make the story more compelling to the American people, I think both sides of this adversarial relationship ought to rethink how the White House is covered and how information about the White House gets out to the public every day, because we're not taking advantages of the technologies as well as we could. I mean, I think you guys have got certainly, I mean, websites have become more sophisticated. The Bush website is much more than the primitive one that was up when Al Gore invented the Internet back in the 1990s. But I think that we should be thinking more beyond just the small group of reporters that are there at that White House every day as the national press that communicates the story of the White House to the country. I think that it'd be great to, you know, turn that back into a swimming pool and chase all the reporters out there and make them cover the White House from the perspectives of individual Americans and really dig harder to find out what's really going on that are going to touch the lives of the American people, rather than relying on a press secretary to come out and put on, you know, what is now, because some idiot back in the Clinton years decided to televise the briefing. It's now just become some theater of the absurd every day with all these people out there to, you know, do combat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm getting on all my...
It's good to be a former. It's good to be a former administration.
But one of the things that's changed...
See, the good thing for Dan having me here is I can say all the things that he thinks, but he would get in trouble if he said it.
But you could see another thing that's changed, too, is the enormous rise in interest groups that exist in Washington and the way in which they have become sophisticated in trying to get into the news cycle and into the president's cycle, figuring out what they can do to get a piece of it. And even members of Congress have, over the years, figured out how to at least developed an interest in that as well.
Mr. Bartlett's boss, Mr. Carr, got in trouble recently for suggesting that press is just yet another one of those special interest groups out there, you know, asking to be serviced every day. So that might be an interesting question, whether or not the press has a somewhat more important role in the process than that. But
Questions to Mark.
That is something I want to get to. But one of the things that, since we were talking about the campaign, I wondered with both of your presidents, because I think I can see it with Bush, what impact did the campaign itself have on the president and his view of a second term, and how is that different than a first?
Well, we had the luxury of prosecuting a case for re-election at a time the American people were very satisfied with the performance of the president in office and really liked the economic benefits of the growth that they were seeing. So we were at a moment that is always gives a great advantage to an incumbent president when people feel largely feel good about the prosperity of the country and feel the country is at peace and not facing any major crises around the world. So it's pretty easy under those circumstances for an incumbent president to prosecute a case for re-election. what President Clinton had a hard time doing, and it came very late in the campaign, was defining some vision for the future that would be compelling. Now, he understood that campaigns for the presidency are never about looking back on your record and, you know, looking
backwards. Well, they are.
Well,
they're not supposed to be, but usually
they
it's
are
looking
indirectly
backward.
Because they are a referendum on whether people feel good about their circumstances at that moment. But if you tell them only what you have done for them in the previous 4 years rather than paint a picture of what's going to happen in the next 4 years, you lose. And that is, you know, most definitely has happened at that. That happened to the current president's father in 1992, I think. And it happened, in some measure, that's, I think, also what happened to Jimmy Carter in 1980. But anyhow, for President Clinton, he finally hit on this notion that we really are about to experience this great passage into a new century, and we have to build a bridge into that new century, and here is what that bridge will look like. So he found for himself, however hackneyed or corny it was, it worked for him because he really believed in it with some passion, that his job as president was to prepare the country for the challenges of the 21st century. And he had a whole delineation of programs that kind of went with that pitch. And I think it was effective because he talked about building that bridge, and that became part of the political vernacular of that campaign. But it was
fascinating because we obviously went back and we studied every reelection of an incumbent, what they did, what we structurally, how they set up their campaign operation vis-a-vis the White House, how it operated, messaging, the whole thing, and really did an analysis. What I was struck, because I vividly remember and thought what a brilliant messaging idea that was, a bridge to the 21st century, and I assumed it was there from the outset. It was at the convention speech, which was very late in the game, I mean, with only about a month or so left in the campaign.
President Clinton had, you know, he had a long list of things that he liked to talk about, and of course he loved campaigning. The other thing that was, I think, you can sense a real difference is Clinton loved being out there and shaking hands and just, you know, he'd work the room, you know, for hours if you let him. You needed a great message. I mean, I think a presidential campaign message works only if it brings together in one narrative the personality of the president, the program they're trying to advance in the country, and if it just rings true and has some vague element of inspiration. So that people really get, you know, they get to see or get to, you know, imagine what this person would be like in the office of the presidency. And it can only come from the individual. For Clinton, the metaphor came from him watching Bob Dole's convention speech, which had been earlier. Mm-hmm. And Dole argued that he wanted to be a bridge to that great World War II generation of the past because that they had done amazing things for America, and we needed to learn from them to deal with the challenges that we face today. And Clinton had a really violent reaction to that. He said, no, that's not right, because you never should be a bridge to the past, you have to be a bridge to the future. And so he started working that idea, and then that's where working with his speechwriters, he came with that metaphor. But you're right, we were working without kind of a core primary vision message until very late in the reelection campaign. Now, and those of us who worked for Senator Kerry kept pressing him in a similar fashion, what's the idea, the compelling idea that you're putting in front of the country? And the best Senator Kerry could get at that was that he was just not going to screw up the country as bad as George Bush had. So it was an entirely negative question, a negative reflection of his idea that Bush's stewardship had not been acceptable. But there was, you know, it's hard to think. I mean, I was there for 8 weeks of the campaign at the end and heard pretty much every speech that Senator Kerry gave. And it was hard to draw out of that the one, you know, crystallized idea that you would sort of say that's the critical difference between this candidate and the incumbent president. I think you can only beat an incumbent president as a challenger if the country, we had half of the equation necessary, a country that was, you know, only pretty much divided 50-50 over President Bush's stewardship, you know, at least half saying that only half saying that they thought he was doing a good job in office, and large majorities saying that the country was going in the wrong direction. And that's a combustible element, but the Challenger only wins if the Challenger comes and makes a very persuasive case why, you know, we ought to fire the current CEO. And that's a much harder thing to do. I think the burden of change is harder for the Challenger.
Mm-hmm. Personally, the president really enjoyed the reelection campaign. There's just materially, personally, professionally, there's just no difference between wanting to be president and being president. And that permeates throughout how you conduct yourself in big and small ways. So when you're running for president as governor of Texas, however prestigious that may be, or governor of California, whatever, it's still not being president. And your confidence level is just not going to be the same. And when you're running as re-election, there's the obvious benefits and backdrops of being an incumbent and Air Force One, et cetera.
Yeah.
But just as importantly, I think even more importantly, is the confidence that comes with of being the leader of the free world for 4 years. And there's a sense of purpose and conviction and ability that you have as an incumbent that is just materially different. But he thoroughly enjoyed it. He was glad that the campaign was centered around, for the most part, you know, there were the trivial days, but for the most part it was on big issues. And it was on big core issues about the direction of our country, which elections ought to be about. And he enjoyed that debate, however controversial it may have been.
I agree with that. I think it was this campaign, unlike the campaign in 2000 and several recent campaigns, did not get hijacked off into these kind of tangential or personality issues nearly as often as
right.
It has been.
We had our digressions with Swift Boats and CBS documents and things like that, which were, I think, a distraction more than anything else. But the one thing, obvious, our big challenge that we had to face, I think, and it's this way in every campaign, but everybody thought about the October surprise. Was there going to be one or not? Our problem was there were so many, the storyline of the presidential campaign was so much being dictated by things that were out of our control. Whether it be Bin Laden in the last
that Bin Laden tape
3 days, 4 days of the campaign, which I think people could argue
it was the Friday before,
or
the missing weapons.
But early in the spring, it was Abu Ghraib. Mm-hmm. It was there's different things that really, because of so much of this of the election itself was about the conduct of the war and whether the right decisions have been made. That war is unpredictable, so every day or every week it could take a different turn. Many times to our advantage, and other times not to our advantage. And that was part of kind of the exciting part of the campaign. You never knew what was going to be the next turn in the debate.
Do you see a difference with the president in the second term in terms of, for example, his explanations of what he's doing and what he's thinking? I guess I'm thinking in particular in his press conferences, and I thought in the press conference in room 450, and he was talking about Europe and the difference in their perspective and our perspective and the difference that September 11th made. It seemed that he was more willing than he's been in the past to talk about his own thinking and just take some risks on what he is what he's thinking at the moment and how he got to where
I think your most immediate experience is to relate it to the past year and a year and a half, which is a campaign environment, which gets back to the thing Mike was saying, is they didn't even do a press conference during the 96 campaign, and you're going to guard yourself. So I think there was probably a scene as that press conference was the press conference shortly after the election, and then even the subsequent ones, there's going to be a little bit of a difference. Sometimes it's you catch them on the right day. There's sometimes I feel like he's been more prepared for a press conference and done worse, and he's been better, or he's been very ill prepared for a press conference in the sense that he's telling us, he's shooing us away as we try to prep him, and he does his best. So. There's no really rhyme. There's nothing. I can't say that there's anything structurally we're doing differently for these press conferences. We had a those comments, we were strategically, we consciously made a decision to have those type of conversations in that press conference, mm-hmm. To help set up. What we were hoping to do in this trip to Europe was to get people to take a second look, particularly overseas, obviously, mm-hmm. in Europe. And sometimes that required us to, for the president, we felt it required the president to lay the groundwork a little bit for them to do that, and I felt we did a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, Martha, you know that in second terms, it has been historically true, presidents tend to start thinking more about foreign policy. They get more and more frustrated mm-hmm. with their inability to get things done at home, and so, you know, going overseas and being a statesman on the world stage tends to be a more attractive opportunity. That was certainly true for President Clinton, but I think in the case of President Bush now, there are some incredible openings in the Middle East, elsewhere. I think the president's trip to Europe was really a chance to maybe get a little fresh air into the relationship with a lot of our key allies, and it looks like that's happened. So I strongly suspect, you know, the conventional wisdom about George Bush is that he's never really liked foreign policy, and he's looking at his watch when he's meeting with foreign leaders and doesn't, you know, enjoy that kind of give and take. But he looked like, in this recent trip, like he was, you know, changing direction a little bit and really getting much more interested in the impact that we can make on world events if we mm-hmm. work more effectively with other countries in the world. I think that's a good thing. And I told mm-hmm. Dan this, I think, having former President Clinton and former President Bush together working on the tsunami relief thing was a brilliant idea, and I think it's also capitalized on a lot of the countries feeling that we ought to start thinking about the rest of the world and what the rest of the world thinks of us. And I think if you can continue some of that, that'll be great.
Mm-hmm. How have you all, or did you prepare President Clinton for press conferences, and what kind of preparations are done for President Bush?
Well, we did. I mean, it's easiest to just describe it mechanically. That's the one thing that I was completely in charge of. I wasn't in charge of much except my own briefing, the words that came out of my mouth every day. But the one thing that I really had responsibility for running soup to nuts was the preparation process. And we'd gather, well, first of all, we'd go scour through the federal government and all the cabinet agencies to solicit from them likely questions, and then get briefing materials and other written materials together so that they could be digested, put into a nice little briefing book, which mostly Clinton did not read, or at least he thumbed through it maybe kind of haphazardly 10 minutes before the briefing began. We would go into the cabinet room, and usually the president would sit in the president's chair, and I would sit directly across from him. The vice president would sit next to President Clinton, because Vice President Gore actually was a very critical element of all the preparation. And he was there and actually very frequently helped, you know, get the tone right on a question. But then we would bring different combinations of senior aides or cabinet people in to prep on specific subjects. And we took it very seriously. We'd spend the better part of a day.
Is it the same day, or was it a day
usually
before?
Usually the same day. Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, we gave up on trying to have primetime evening news conferences, so we generally did them in the early afternoon, and we'd prep from, you know, 9:30 until 1 or 2 o'clock pretty solidly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we'd start maybe a day before. But it was, you know, part of the process was asking the meanest, nastiest question you could think of, which was my assignment, and having the president look at you and say, that's the trouble with you and your friends in the press. You're trying to destroy this country. Which frequently was the result of some mean question. It's a little, once you get over just how kind of intimidating the setting is, to be able to sit there and throw rotten tomatoes at the President of the United States actually can be kind of fun.
It's fun.
Dan?
Ours is, it's, for the button-down corporate style that we've just described, ours is a little more informal. I would say that Press Secretary Scott McClellan and I guess I do more offense, he does more defense. I work more with him about what proactively the points we want to try to make and how we do that, and I usually work with him directly on that. After getting input from senior staff.
You mean you go by yourself and talk to him?
It's done a different way, sometimes orally, sometimes in writing. It just depends. And then Scott is very good at the prediction part about what you're going to get. This is what's on the press's mind. This is how they're going to ask it. And I'm sure that y'all had a pretty good batting record. It's rare that a question is thrown that we haven't been prepared for, almost down to
the way it's worded.
The way it's worded. Right. I mean, it is. And most times we found ourselves to be more prepared. But we do it usually day. Usually we give him some materials. We'll write down the type of questions he can expect, and he'll get them, you know, a day or two in advance. He likes to orally go through answers. He doesn't like, you know, big written answers out. Today I'm going to say, you know, just kind of. So we work it through that a little bit differently in that regard. And then we do a session the day of, usually for you know, it's varied. It depends on the issues. I mean, there's days that we knew in our last press conference that it was going to be Iraq and Social Security. I mean, we just knew that nothing else really was going to come up, and that was the case. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we got one other question. You can cover that in an hour. I mean, it usually. So it just depends on what the issue set out there and what the mood is of the press, how much time we have to use.
One comment, I would add something that William Safire has noted in writing about presidential press conferences and the reason why it's good for White Houses to have them. It really is true that they are action-forcing events within the government, too, because each cabinet agency has to prepare an answer on whatever its hot topic is and send in the suggested guidance or talking points on that issue. And it goes in front of the president. The president looks at it and says, "Well, this is drivel," and you tell him, "Well, that, sir, is your policy." Then you know it usually provokes some kind of conversation between the president and that cabinet agency.
That's absolutely true.
And that is a very valuable thing because just the fact that you're having this press conference then crystallizes the policymaking process a little bit. And I think they have merit more for that reason than for whatever information, you know, comes out of these sessions for the American people, because they really do help the government function more efficiently.
And speeches as well. Speeches and press conferences.
Yes.
And wouldn't you say short question and answer sessions? Because the short question and answer sessions, too, you have to prepare for at least what's hot for the day.
You do, but those always tend to be what Dan just called more the defensive question. You're actually deflecting whatever the headline is of the day, because that is usually off the point of what you're trying to focus. You don't use those sessions to articulate new policy or to, you know, make major pronouncements. Rarely. I mean, sometimes you do because there's something that's happening in the world and you do need to say something new, but very rarely is it used for that case, in my experience.
Can you think of something that you found out in the preparations for a press conference, say from departments, that that you hadn't known, or about a policy, that wasn't working as well?
That'd be easier for him to answer. I'm going to probably refer.
Well, you'd see substantial disagreement sometimes on some basics. I mean, a good example, we uncovered some very fundamental disagreements within government about the don't ask, don't tell policy of the Pentagon by comparing what Veterans Affairs Department would say, what the Pentagon would say, and then what our own liaison office was saying that worked more directly with the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual community. And there was a noticeable rift in government about basic information. And if you scratched away at that, then you kind of found that there were some real policy debates too. And I think that's the kind of, it's the clearinghouse function of the press conference to really uncover what's the interagency process has gotten bogged down on. And that does happen a lot.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the role of the press corps in government. The president has several times noted when he was going to take questions. I remember when Karzai was there and they did one in the Rose Garden. He said, "Well, let's, in the tradition of democracy, let's take questions." And then he's referred to that more than once, the role of the press in a democracy. and the need for them to be able to ask questions. Andy Card was talking about the press and said that the press didn't represent anybody, that that the only people who represented the American people were those people who were elected, and that they really didn't have that kind, didn't have a function. And it seemed to me that's a different kind of view. And so I wonder if you can give some of what the president's, both of your president's view, and then view of other people in the White House.
Well, one's higher on the food chain than the other, so I'm going to go with the president.
I think that was not the point he was trying to make. I mean, he would be the first to say that was inartfully.
Right. I think the point he was making a distinction between the National Press Corps is not in and of itself the only keeper of all, information and public information to the public. There's other ways to communicate to the public about.
But was talking about as a surrogate for the public, that did the press represent the public in that way?
Well, I definitely think the president believes they do, and I think he has said it on more than one occasion. And he feels like the relationship between the media and the president or public officials writ large is important. This has been played out in real time with the backdrop of our discussions with Russia. I think when the president says that with Karzai or others, because we're talking about people who are new democracies, it's important that there be an understanding that the role of a free press plays. It's critical, and he does it. You know, will it be adversarial at times? Of course, but at the same time, for the most part, both on a personal level, as far as he's not like he dislikes the reporters in the room. He doesn't. He actually gets along with a lot of them. Does he agree with everything they print? Of course not. But he does have a healthy respect, and that's why when the issue of Armstrong, yeah, Williams and those things came out about, uh-huh, paid media commentators, that why he came out so strongly against it. And that's his view, and that's what he's told me and other people who are in charge of the communications to operate.
I think every president chafes at how easily the National Press Corps there in the White House will suddenly, you know, lurch off in the direction of some issue that the president considers to be relatively minor. Now, whether or not they are relatively minor issues is, you know, debatable, obviously, in every case. But that's the phenomenon. Mm-hmm. The phenomenon is I'm sitting here, I'm working, you know, my butt off for the American people, trying to get all these things done, and then this press corps, they, all they want to do is hijack the debate and talk about this stuff that is just inconsequential.
Like Monica Lewinsky?
Well, yeah, Monica Lewinsky, although I think in his heart of hearts, Bill Clinton knew that that was a serious matter. But on the other hand, day after day, at the same volume that story went on day after day, at some point you obviously get exasperated. But I think that's true. I think that's been true of every president. I mean, I think you've written that you can go all the way back to George Washington and find pretty good evidence that even the number one president thought the press could be up to no good sometimes. And I think that this all relates back to something Dan talked about. It's the enormous difficulty of communicating coherently in a country this big when there's not, you know, an established national press that everybody reads every day, where the audience is quite fragmented, getting information from multiple sources, and it's very difficult to actually get reliable information out to the American people. It's very, very hard to communicate effectively, and I think that's the reaction to this. So when some of your precious airtime gets burned on something that you don't consider to be as important an issue, or you know, what typically happens, things become scandals even when you are trying to protest that it's not a scandal. And we had, Lord knows, many examples of that in the Clinton White House. I think presidents do get, you know, a little bit frosty, and they really begin to wonder, are these people sitting here in this briefing room really surrogates for the American people? Because they begin to say, you know, I talk to Americans a lot, I know what's on their mind. It's not what these people are asking me about. Mm-hmm. And I think every president feels that a little bit.
Although it's interesting, if you'd ask which of these two presidents have more amicable relationships personally, it's probably your boss. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, just as I think personally, it's more affable, maybe. But I have one question, actually. I know I'm not supposed to ask questions. Do you think you get any advantage in pulling the quick announcement that the president's going to come down here in a half an hour and so get ready for a press conference? I personally have felt that the questions are better and more direct when the reporters haven't had 24 hours to sit there and carefully hone them, and because usually those are such ponderous, pompous, complicated questions that they're not nearly as useful to the public as the questions that come, you know, off the top of the head.
I probably agree with that. I mean, I think, the president kind of makes fun of me. He's like, this won't give them the peacocks to go home to put on their best suit and make sure that they, you know, get a chance to, you know, prep up and everything so they can deliver it to the president and they can wink in the camera to their family back at home and all that. He thinks it becomes more about the spectacle of the press conference than it does about the actual issues and more spontaneity and just going down there. His father did a lot. His father used to go down unannounced all the time. They just kind of, he'd literally walk down there.
He did, but they were different in the sense that he did it just on a regular basis to do it, whereas when you all call a press conference, it's usually here's an issue or two issues.
He didn't do them. He didn't do them in the absence of formal press conferences either, because he still had formal press conferences in addition to the.
Well, he did not have many Easter.
He didn't have many. No, I know, but I mean, they still had formal press.
George W. Bush had more nighttime Easter than his father. But one of the things that you notice, say, in the last press conference is that because he's had one a month, that people don't put in the whole, you know, five different questions because they have a sense that they're going to have an opportunity. So it's not just how much time they have to dream up questions, but also just the fact that they have some regularity to them
regular.
Now.
Yeah,
so it's just was a much more amicable environment, I thought.
And then the other thing, did I gather that they are doing more formal briefings with other, like, sub-cabinet people or others?
There are more of them, yeah. There have been more.
So I am a big believer in that. I felt that if you expose the press to people who were real experts in their field within government, sometimes not necessarily political appointees who were part of the president's team, but people who really just knew a lot about the subjects that you were trying to get the press to focus on, that was a good use of time. I never believed that you took away from the importance of the president's words by having some other government official out there doing a briefing on the record.
I think we did that, for example, early in January, even before the State of the Union. We set up basically either off the record or deep background meetings with our Social Security expert. And it really was just kind of, here's Social Security 101, this is what we think is the problem. This is a very technical, complex issue, and we did it in four or five different waves, bringing in different members of the White House press corps, just to allow them to ask any question they wanted about. Not what the president's going to, obviously he wasn't going to shed any light on what the president knew was going to say, but basically, A, why do you think it's a problem? It gave him a chance from an actuarial standpoint to kind of walk through the mechanics of Social Security, what we thought it was. And we got a lot of positive feedback from that. Mm-hmm. And there were other towns, I think where
the Rocky elections, you did you did a background on that too.
Yeah, that's right. And we hope to continue to do it. I think the hardest time to do it is before a presidential decision. For example, right now the president is considering about how we can strengthen what's called the EU3, the three European nations that are in direct negotiations with Iran about how we can get them to discontinue their nuclear reprocessing. And we're getting a lot of requests from the press. Will you do a background briefing on this and do this and tell us? And inevitably what happens in this sense that things start coming either in background briefings or elsewhere, things that start floating about that start, I think, restricting the type of flexibility you want to give the president because then people feel authorized to start floating different rationales mm-hmm. for or against different items, and then that becomes becomes the filter in which the president then has to make a decision. And you as a staffer, it's your job to try to create the best environment possible for the president to make a decision without, you know, having to take those things in consideration. And so, but that doesn't mean after we make a decision, we should then take a look under the hood and explain our thinking on it. We try to do that. We could probably do a better job.
When I was at the White House, would have agreed with what you just said. But as more in time now looking back, I feel like we get such little coverage of the real process of policymaking and how decisions get vetted and taken up to the president and what the mechanics are. I mean, you make a valuable point that you restrict the president's ability to actually make the decision if everybody's out there sort of spinning their own particular view of what the decision should be. On the other hand, if you have some of that, then people get a better sense of how tough some of these decisions are, because I think that's what's missing from a lot of the press coverage that we get now. We don't get much about how government really functions and really works. We get a lot about politics and about, you know, who's positioning what and who's spinning what and who's up and who's down, but not much about, you know, the real work.
If I feel confident that would be, it would replace and not be an addition to, because it's too simple to write, well, was Rumsfeld for it? Was Powell against it?
Yeah.
Was that, you know, who's winning the debate today is what it always comes down to. Right. And that doesn't serve the public policy.
And it's not the way it really works.
Right. that's the most critical point.
Well, let's go to some questions. Towson, do you have a question?
Wake up, in Towson. You're on.
I do. Goes out to Dan Bartlett. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Number one, thanks for showing up tonight, you know, for sitting in on this. My question, by what time do you, or what point, pretty much sure the flavor of the news?
The microphone isn't working.
You're making it too easy on Dan Bartlett because he can only answer every other word. Yeah, I think you need to put the microphone very close to you because that's what's cutting out.
Okay. I think so too. Is this better?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, all right. Sorry about that. Number one, thanks for stopping in tonight. And by what time of the day do you pretty much know what the news flavor of the day is? You mentioned before news flavor of the day. By what time do you know what the flavor is, and you go about putting that out?
I would say that we do a wrap-up meeting every evening with in which a handful of us get together in the chief of staff's office to kind of take a stock of the day. And I can already at that point, Scott McClellan, myself, or others, I can already tell you what tomorrow's going to be like. We have a sense of where the stories are going. We have a sense of what the network news was that night, but you also, it's pretty predicting about where it's going to go. There's always probably at that time, you're going to have a story, a bigger story that maybe made the major news organizations are working on that you're reacting to. So I would say most of the time we're pretty much got a heads up on what's going to happen the night before. You now have a situation also where a lot of the major news organizations, the newspapers anyways, post their stories the night before. So the Washington Post and New York Times, which I think has the most impact on network news and on TV news and who they're going to be booking on their TV the next day, they're up on the web by 9 or 10 o'clock the night before. If it's not there, we have to have our act together before Scott McClellan, the press secretary, gaggles, which is typically in the 9 o'clock hour that morning, So we use I, myself, and others get in early, and we've covered all the news papers and other forms of media. We have both senior staff meetings and communications meetings all before, and they have conference calls with the cabinet, relevant cabinet agencies, all before 9:15 a.m. So Scott, who then has to go before to get his daily pulse of where the, really what the gaggle is supposed to be is just that, a pulse check for the press secretary and the press corps with each other to say what's going on. But we use it as more of an indicator. He needs it to prepare for the briefing later than today, but also if the president is going to be taking questions that day, you get a sense of what the news is going to be that day and what we're going to have to deal with. And we get a sense of if we had one strategy thinking about dealing with an issue, you know real quickly whether that strategy is going to work or not, whether you need to go back to the drawing board and get more information. So if you don't know by 9:15, you're way behind the ball.
It was the exact same process. Now, in the pre-internet days, I used to get up at 4:30 in the morning and I'd read the newspapers. I'd read pretty thoroughly the Washington Post, Washington Times, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal. And then I'd go take my dogs for a walk and listen to NPR and, well, actually, you could get BBC on before NPR. And then I'd come back and take a shower, and in the shower, I'd pretty much do the briefing in my head for that day. And I'd start thinking of what line I was going to use on which question. And then we'd go through the same morning meetings and try out different, you say, what if we say this, what if we say that? And then take that, in some many cases, take it to the president. If it was something where we were trying to nip something in the bud early in the day, we'd have to kind of get a clearance from him to say, here's what we're going to put out today. Or we could hold it over and do it later in the briefing. We used that gaggle in the morning much less as a formal briefing and much more as a temperature taking.
Ours really changed after the 9/11.
Yeah.
And it became, we actually, the gaggle used to be in the press secretary's office.
Right.
And we had to move it to the briefing room. It's off camera because there's such a demand for the press to be there because there are so much developments overnight. And that is particularly in the wartime that in which so many developments are happening overseas, which news cycles are so much ahead of us, we were waking up to a lot of news that we got to react to as well, whether it be in the Middle East, whether it be in Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera. And so that part of it has required us to be a little more nimble in the morning because we're opening up to this.
We kept it in the press secretary's office and did not make a transcript, which mm-hmm. was also made it much more freewheeling and more informal. And I think it was useful to the press, but for the reasons that you mentioned, with a wartime news cycle, you probably had to go to a more formal.
And once you start something, you can never go back.
But you've transcribed it from the beginning. Right, and it was sent by email.
Is
sent
that right?
By email around
from the beginning?
Around the government. I think it's pretty much at the beginning, and so it has another purpose, which is to tell people within the administration what to talk about and also what not to talk about. Yeah, so that it coordinates there. Anybody here have a question?
This is for Mr. Morley
here. You kind of hold on for a second because we need to get you the microphone so they can hear in Towson. Yeah.
This is for the Bush administration as far as communications. Given the recent developments in the Middle East and as rapid as they have been since the Iraqi elections as far as calls for democracy, et cetera, Lebanon, how do you see America's image in the world changing, especially in Europe and especially in Arab countries? And how is America, the White House specifically, shaping the image across overseas? I mean, this is rapid 24-hour news, sort of. How is the White House shaping the communications overseas specifically?
Well, it's an enormous challenge, and one in which has only become more complex with the advent of Al Jazeera and other Arab media satellites, which is good and bad in the sense it's good because they've penetrated very close societies that have never had access to the outside world. The unfortunate aspect of it is a lot of stuff they have access to, and like Al Jazeera is very insightful. So that has been a challenge in which they have done they are reaching the person on the street
in a very effective way. And it's required us, and it's going to require us. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. The developments and actions on the ground are going to speak louder than anything that we do from a communication standpoint, both in the good sense of elections being held with the vivid aspect of peaceful demonstrations in Lebanon, the purple ink on Iraqis' hands, to the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine, whatever it may be. Those symbolic and real developments are always going to be our best communication devices because they speak louder than anything we could claim. Other aspects of our of what actually happens speak louder too. Where we drop bombs, where we don't, where we the military is can do enormous good, but also in the nature of war, there can be it can also be quite messy, and that makes for a challenging communications environment. One thing we did in the Afghanistan, at the beginning of the Afghanistan conflict, was we recognized that, and this was actually based on a lot of counsel from Prime Minister Blair's communications operation, because they had dealt with it in Kosovo, and that was we found ourselves, when the Taliban was still in existence in Afghanistan, we found ourselves waking up each day being on the defensive because of the time change they would make. They had two clowns there who really had, from the Taliban, making all kind of ridiculous comments saying that we were carpet bombing civilians, all this. And they might have been ludicrous, but we still had to respond to them. And it put us on the defensive. So we set up what was called coalition information centers, both in Islamabad, Pakistan, in London, and in Washington, in which we put communicators and people on the ground in the news cycle to better deal with the issues in a real-time basis. At first, it was just from a defensive standpoint to make sure that we knock these things down. But then we found it to be a proactive tool in which we would begin our messaging over there, roll it this way, in which then London would add to it, and then we would add a component when we woke up and did something here in Washington. A good example of that was when we talked about Afghan women, and Mrs. Bush did the radio address on behalf of the president to talk about women. But part that a lot of people know, we also had Prime Minister Blair's wife do something earlier in that day, and we did something with with some women in Afghanistan that day as well. So it was a rolling message. So we need to be more proactive and deal with things in a real-time basis. But we're going to have to fundamentally reform the way that we communicate in ways and use diplomacy on the ground because of satellite TV and things like that. We're going to have to get better, and we're working at that. For example, in some countries, I mean, we're very good at government-to-government communications. We have an ambassador, they have an ambassador, you go speak to them, you do this. Well, in some countries, they don't like their government. And the more communication, the more you're seeing with the government, the worse off you are with the public. So you got to find other ways to communicate directly mm-hmm. with the people. And we're looking at ways to do that. How do we have, to make sure there's competing satellite air television that we're helping fund, very much in the vein of Radio Free Europe back in the days of the Cold War. We're doing similar things with satellite TV. And that'll continue to be a challenge, though, and something that is an added component of our daily communications life that wasn't that way in this way that it probably should have been before 9/11.
We made a significant error as a nation when we dismantled the U.S. Information Agency in the 1990s. That was a cadre of, I think, very experienced, knowledgeable government workers in each country who were charged with the responsibility of communicating through the local media stories about the United States of America. They ran cultural exchanges, they ran libraries, they ran information centers where people, local citizens, could come in and actually learn something about the United States. And we dismantled it. We have underinvested in what we would call public diplomacy, which is telling the story of our country. And I also think, this will probably be mildly critical, Dan, I think we also haven't been conscious enough of the tonal quality of how we communicate from the president on down, because sometimes I think we come across very arrogantly in the ears and eyes of the world, and we
seem to be abusing the status we have now as a superpower. I think we have to be conscious that all of those elements fit together. It's the quality of the policy, it's how we communicate it, it's how effectively we reach channels that aren't seen as just propaganda arms either for our government or for a host government. And it requires, I think, some of the best and most talented people in government. And I think that's, we're beginning to recognize that. I think we were probably slow to recognize that in the Clinton years, and I think events in the world have made it necessary for the current White House to recognize this. But it's an area that I hope will be, you know, with a lot of students here and there, if it's an area that you're interested in, one that good people pursue as careers, because we've got to do a lot better at it.
One thing just to add to the multiple audience issue is what you're talking about. We're not just speaking to our constituents here, but you are speaking to the world. And I think the president has learned that we can, he can, and others can have one intention. And the president, the first one to say, is not the most eloquent speaker himself. And I think, for example, a good example that he would probably mention was when he said, bring it on. And he really was, in the truest sense, speaking to the troops, which was basically him saying, buddy, I got confidence in you. They can bring whatever they can, as hard as they can, and I got confidence that our troops are superior, better, more, you know, prepared, and can beat them. And he was trying to have a communication in which he was trying to show his confidence in them. But he recognized after saying it and seeing the fallout that it looked arrogant or, you know, looked too bravado, that you were inviting violence. And that obviously wasn't what he wanted to do. And sometimes it's trial by error. You learn from your mistakes like that.
Mm-hmm. Towson?
I mean, you know, another good example of that is I, having talked to you about this, I know that the mission accomplished banner on the Eisenhower was a message of pride in the troops who had done the work that they were there to do. But when that message was then broadcast around the world, it took on a whole different meaning. And, of course, in the face of events that turned sour afterwards, it
you
took on a whole different...
we get so
little on the Democratic side to cheer about. We have to remind small victories. No, I having been there and know how bad things can go sometimes, it's usually not nearly as well plotted. If we were as smart and as crafty as everyone thought we were.
It looks like Towson has dropped out here.
You timed out.
I'm sure they can hear.
So, Towson, are you there?
7:30.
Yeah.
Okay. Too bad you guys missed the party.
Okay. Let's take one more here.
There you go.
Oh, there you go. No, it's okay. You can take it. And I'll just give them one more.
Campaign themes, Reagan, Morning in America, Building a Bridge Across the 21st Century, Compassionate Conservatism. I worked on the campaign last year, and I woke up November 3rd, I heard flip-flop, I'm tough, and I heard I have a brain and Bush is dumb. I'm wondering what the themes were of the campaign last year, and if you think just because it was a 50-50 thing, if themes that were put out by both sides got lost because of how close it was.
I think that, I mean, I kind of alluded to this already. I think it was hard for Senator Kerry to crystallize his argument for change into one compelling phrase that would be easy to put on a bumper strip. He had lots of things he wanted to talk about, lots of things that he wanted to argue would be different if he got elected president. And he argued that case every single day, but it was hard for people to boil it down to one simple thing that they could grab a hold of, other than he would be a lot different from Bush because he clearly doesn't like Bush. And that came through, you know, pretty loud and clear. On the other hand, I don't think that we heard a strong, compelling case about why we need to reform Social Security, why we need to do certain things, and that part of the problem that I think that Dan wrestles with now is that there was not a corresponding argument on the other side about where America would head in the next 4 years. And sometimes you just can't do that. I mean, this is a very close election, and, you know, you can't generally seen that if an incumbent starts laying out a second-term agenda, that's a little presumptuous. and they maybe just decided they couldn't take the risk of doing that. But it affects, the point is it affects the ability to govern, how you frame the argument and the choice you want the people to concentrate on in the election. And I don't think on the Kerry side we frame that choice in a way that gave people something to hold on to that convinced them that Kerry would take the country in a better direction. Now we made that argument and that sale successfully for about 43% of the American people. And then we picked up at the end some people who really were struggling and probably ended up making it a pretty close election in the end of the day. So I'm not saying that we totally failed, because we obviously were pretty persuasive to half the country. But I think in the end, there's that kind of added little bit that has to come from inspiration and a sense of vision. And I think that's always at the end what ends up electing a president. And a lot of other things go into it. It's a lot more complicated than that, but I personally think it's that little added element that makes the difference at the margin, especially in a very close election like this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this became very much a retrospective election on Bush's decisions. That's where they wanted to have the debate. It's where we were obviously comfortable having the debate. I don't think anybody had much ambiguity about what the president's, you know, vision was, what he was doing, both on foreign policy and domestic. We talked a lot in our convention speech about an ownership society, having given people more control. But one thing that, because of that, the other thing you look at as far as just messaging themes, like bumper sticker-like themes, are traits. I mean, you really never know what the issue is going to be that a president's going to have to deal with. 9/11 is a good example. That was not a part of the core debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush back in 2000, who was going to deal with the terrorist event. So then you have to kind of get a sense of the person and what type of person you want to be as president, because we don't know what is going to be ahead of us in the next 4 years. So we spent a lot of time from a strategy, from a strategic standpoint and communication standpoint, of trying to elevate certain traits of the president and elevate certain traits of our opponent.
Elevate is not exactly the word.
Bring to the fore. So one of the key components, I think, of our message, and I think the one that ultimately helped this president, was we might not always like what he's for, but we know where he comes from. We know what he's about. We know what his core convictions are. We know why he's doing the things he is, and he's predictable, and we live in unpredictable times. I'm not always going to agree with it, but we know what we're getting with Bush, and I think we did a good job, and Senator Kerry helped us along the way at critical moments, is that they didn't articulate that there was a core conviction, consistency, vision, because that's really what challengers, a big hurdle to get over, is to articulate a vision of what you do differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've run over our time, so I think we'll have to call it a night. And thank you very, very much.
Good question.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.